You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Wade Hicks, Jr. Wade, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Wade, I saw online a story, NDAA critic stranded in Hawaii after turning up on no-fly list. I want to get to that in detail in a second, but before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, just give them a little bit of background about who you are, where you're from, and what do you do.
My name's Wade Hicks, Jr. I'm from Gulfport, Mississippi. My wife is a U.S. Naval officer with the Seabees. She was deployed over into Okinawa from her home port in Gulfport, Mississippi. I decided I was going to go take a flight out to go see her months ago, and we've been planning this for a long time, trying to get things done, trying to balance spending time with my son and things like that, trying to get my school lined up, because I'm going back to school right now for my degree in history. I also want to get a Juris Doctorate in Constitutional law by the time all of this stuff is said and done. Hopefully I'll be successful in that endeavor. I'm 34 years old. I was a professional mariner by trade. I've worked on some contract vessels with Military Sealift Command that were actually owned by a private corporation known as Edison Swest Offshore. So I've had some connections with the military through that type of employment. So I've held some security clearances doing that job, working ocean surveillance and submarine support. So that's a little bit about my background there as far as clearances and things like that. I'm also a certified volunteer firefighter and a first responder. I held those certifications before 9/11, which I had some interesting views about 9/11 that probably led to me being put on a no-fly list. I've also done search and rescue. I've led search and rescue operations for Hurricane Katrina back in Hancock County. After the storm, I got my amateur radio license, started doing work and getting more vocally active on the radio on WQRZ. I started a radio show called The Free Speech Zone, started talking about constitutional issues and 9/11 and things like that. I started getting involved in the Tea Party movement. I hosted an American Freedom Day rally on July 4th back in 2009. There's some videos of that up on YouTube if you were to Google my name. In addition to all the stories about my no-fly list detention, you'll find those videos as well. So I've been really outspoken about the Constitution for quite a long time. So that's really a good basic understanding about who I am, where I've come from, and some of my background.
You're just a regular American who's concerned about the direction of the country, and you think probably that we should return more to the way the founders had originally planned.
Yes, I do. One of the real important issues that concerns me about the direction of this country is going is our willingness as a society to willingly trade our liberty for security. Benjamin Franklin said well over 200 years ago, those that are willing to trade liberty for security deserve neither. And that's where we're at today. We really don't deserve the freedoms that we have because we've just given them away and allowed government to dictate every aspect of our lives. If you told somebody 40 years ago that if you wanted to get on an airplane, someone would have to stick their hands down your pants, you'd probably end up in jail for some form of assault if that would happen. But today, people just say, well, you know what? I'm just going to let them search me because they're going to search everybody else and it's just the right thing to do. They never think about themselves being violated. And they go along to get along, and I'm not made of that same material. I cannot do that. I stand on principle, and I've said it before, this entire situation that transpired. If they would have basically told me to put up or shut up or they were going to kill me, I would have made them go ahead and take me out because that's one thing that you have to stand up for. And I may have never been in the military. I'm not a veteran, but I can tell you one thing. I'm ready to die for an oath that I've taken. Not officially, of course, but I've taken the oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I'm willing to die for that oath, and more so than some of the people that have taken it with reservations. The
country needs more people like you, obviously. Now, before we go into exactly what happened, we might as well elaborate a little bit on your 9/11 views, because you think that that might have something to do with what happened here. Why don't you go ahead and let the audience know what they are?
Yeah, well, back in 2004, 2005, I took a trip over to Scotland. I was at the Fast Lane submarine base in Scotland. Went out in the night drinking on Liberty, ran into some Royal Marines, and they wanted to get into a drinking contest, and it didn't work out too well for them because they were quite inebriated by the time the drinking contest started. So I was just swapping out empty glasses for full glasses, and they were never the wiser. So they really thought I had a really high tolerance for alcohol and made a bunch of friends really instantly that night. Well, one of the Marines, I guess he was kind of questioning 9/11, and the next day after everybody had sobered up, I ran into him out in town, and he says, hey, I got a video that I think you'd like to see, but you don't need to watch it now. Just check it out on the way home. It's yours. You can keep it. So I said, okay, cool, thanks. Sometimes I look back at that day and go, why did I ever take that video and watch it? because it changed my life. I remember sitting on the couch after I got out of bed. My dad told me that the World Trade Center was on fire. I was like, really? Oh, it's pretty interesting. Newly certified firefighter. So I'm glued to the television. I see the second plane hit and then the buildings collapse. And when those buildings collapsed, something didn't look right. Something struck me as wrong. It didn't look natural. It almost looked like a scene off of a movie. And I questioned it then, but not in the sense that I did after I watched that video in 2005. And the video was 9/11 in plain sight.
Okay.
After I've seen that video, my life fundamentally changed. I started doing my own research online. 9/11 Loose Change came out. I started watching all of these videos that were asking questions and raising up valid points. And it seemed that the more that people were trying to ask about 9/11, the more they were being demonized and called crazy conspiracy theorists and just general nut jobs for even questioning the official story. And a lot of this stuff was starting to come out before the 9/11 Commission was completely finished with its final product. It was a very sensitive time where they were asking these questions, but they wasn't getting answers. The family members wasn't getting answers and things like that. And those videos really hit on a lot of interesting points that did point to there was some sort of conspiracy involved. But it's really hard to get people to watch that type of video and understand what's going on because it is a conspiracy theory. It's a very good explanation to call it a conspiracy theory because you formulated a hypothesis that something is wrong. You've tested it and retested it until the point where you keep coming up with the same answer, that there is a conspiracy involved. So you are theorizing that there is a conspiracy. So it's a very accurate statement when you call a person a conspiracy theorist. And I accept it more as a term of endearment than a derogatory statement. What really, really hit home and started changing my views where I became more outspoken about 9/11 was when Richard Gage, A1A, and his group that he founded, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth,
right,
coming out with some of their investigations and their documentaries and their material, because they looked at it from a non-conspiratorial point of view where they asked basic questions. How does steel function in this situation? And they used the scientific method, and they kept doing it over and over again. They would develop a hypothesis, test it out, and retest it and retest it, and keep coming up to the same conclusion. The official narrative and the official description of NIST, which is National Institute of Standards and Technologies, does not make scientific sense. And that really was very compelling evidence. It was compelling evidence that I showed to everyone around me. And they've agreed that, yes, the official story is flawed. So I've asked around and even mentioned to congressmen and senators a few years ago, hey, I gave them a DVD, tell them to look at it, and they'd never look at it. It's too much of a hot potato to touch because the normalcy bias is there. What if that official narrative really is wrong and we were lied to about that? And that really shocks people to their core. So my goal was to try to wake people up to the possibility that they have been lied to, and this is not the first time, and it won't be the last. So I think some of those views could have contributed to the situation that I was just involved in.
Basically, thought crimes.
Exactly. It's a very Orwellian type of environment where they almost have the Ministry of Information repackaging the stories as quickly as they come in and changing history. Because one thing I'm learning as being a student of history is only his story. There's always multiple sides of history. And somewhere in the middle of all of it, there lies the truth. And the truth is usually left up to interpretation. But if you take the mean of all of the different accounts, you can get a pretty accurate representation of what's accurate.
Well, that's very well said. And I myself have interviewed Richard Gage before several years ago and went over the whole bit of research that Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth had done. He sent me the DVDs out and I watched them all, and it is very persuasive. And these are, of course, scientists, basically. They're structural engineers and they know how, as you said, they know how steel functions. But the problem is trying to wake people up to see that. It seems like the government really doesn't have to worry about anything because most Americans are literally asleep at the switch. Would you agree with that?
That's a very accurate statement. And the ones that you do try to inform, I'm the type of person that dumps the information on them like a ton of bricks.
Right.
And they either can digest it or they get crushed by it. And that's probably not the best way to go about giving people this type of information. But I believe that if we don't get enough people woke up to not necessarily 9/11, because there's probably nothing that will ever be done about that, but to get into the mindset that you cannot blindly believe everything government tells you is true. In my situation right here, the government said that basically I was a terrorist and I was on the no-fly list. And I could tell you right now, even though no one come out and said it, here on the Navy base, me walking around, of course, nobody offers anybody rides anymore. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, if I'd have been on the Navy base, I couldn't have walked a block and somebody, hey, bud, need a ride? But it's gotten away from that where people really keep to themselves, only worry about themselves, and they become really selfish. But going to the JAG over here on base, explaining my situation, even though I did go, it turns out, to the prosecution side of the fence to try to get some help. A lawyer's a lawyer as far as I'm concerned, and they can prepare some paperwork for me. And I really didn't get any level of help or a warm and fuzzy from the JAG here. And it kind of upset me a little bit because, you know, it's like, it's your job to represent me. And all I'm asking you to do is help me fill out some forms to submit to the TSA. That's not putting you in an adversarial position. All you're doing is acting as a liaison to help me fill out these forms. If I had a computer and a printer and a good internet connection, I'd do it myself. But all I came over here was with a backpack and a cell phone. So I really didn't have the resources to do it. And I wound up doing most of the work myself, going to the library over at Hickam and filling out the forms and the documents and everything else like that, because they had so much bureaucratic red tape with, oh, the privacy thing, and we got to put this in a different folder if it has your personal information on it. And I just didn't get a warm and fuzzy from that experience.
Right.
And I went to the chaplain's office to try to get some help because I didn't know how long I was going to be stuck here on base. So I went to the chaplain's office to see if maybe he could work some magic up through the command structure here at Pearl Harbor where I could go into a room and stay on the Navy's dime, which would basically be on the taxpayer's dime. After all, I was stranded here as a result of the government's blunder that has now been, of course, seen. And all of a sudden, I've been released off the no-fly list. Next thing I know, I'm getting calls from my wife telling me that the CEC, the Civil Engineer Corps, over here, they're going to be contacting you to help you out with rides or whatever you need. And it's like, I've been over here since Sunday. You would think that a stranded service member's spouse could at least get a break on something because obviously there's some sort of misunderstanding, but nothing came until it was done. I was ready to go. I was cleared from any wrongdoing. It was late. I admit they probably should have reached out to me a little bit sooner. I'm not bitter about it in any way. I understand I was a pretty hot potato, and it seems that in the military, just as in the civilian world, people are climbing the ladders and they push people off to get up to the top. And I totally understand how that structure works. I had a friend of mine who's a patriot back in Mississippi. His younger brother is a commander that's actually stationed over here on the same base. Works 10-hour days. I don't know what his job is. I'm not going to mention his name or anything. But he was more concerned with contacting base security to figure out why I was on this base. So that was kind of disturbing.
Right.
But I think now the whole situation's rectified itself through no assistance from the Navy. I'm not trying to badmouth them in any way, shape, or form. It's just that you get in a position, and if you don't follow and go with the flow of those above you, even though officers swear an oath to the Constitution and nothing above that, the Constitution's their oath. But if they do something that doesn't go with policy or something like that, it could be a career killer for them. So I think that's why I was not assisted as much as I probably should have, given the situation. The worst thing that could happen is, okay, I'm still on the no-fly list, but at least they've given me a ride over here to go to the library to print out something, or a ride over here to talk to somebody to see if they could help with some paperwork or something like that. But today, I had a very good experience. I met a commander. He gave me a ride over to the AMC terminal and got me set up for getting ready to fly out Space A tomorrow. I'm grateful for that because it's about a 5 or 6 mile walk from where I'm staying at the
right.
Utah Hall over to the AMC terminal, and I'd prefer not to walk that.
Now, you are, of course, right now on Pearl Harbor. You're in Navy lodging, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Let's start from the beginning. When did this whole, I don't want to call it a fiasco, because that's probably too light of a word, because basically what happened was that you were prevented from continuing on with your flight, and you were left in this limbo where the possibility existed that you would have to wait a minimum of 45 days to find out if you could fly again. Is that right?
That's correct.
How did it all start? Go back to the day when you started traveling. Where were you? I know you were traveling on military flights in what used to be called MAC, the Military Airlift Command, which is different now. What's it called right now,
Wayne? It's now the Air Mobility Command.
Okay. Go ahead. Start from the beginning.
Well, my journey started with some planning. I've been planning the vacation with the wife for some time. Originally, it was going to happen in September, but some things going on with her job and the end of the fiscal year kept pushing it further and further to the right. And it was getting buttoned up to the point where I wanted to get the trip done and completed before election time, because there were some issues concerning potential civil unrest that I didn't want to be driving across the country during that time period. So it was getting up to crunch time, and we decided that the first week, second week of October was probably the best time to initiate the trip. So I went online, I planned my rest area stops and sleep breaks to drive. I drove from Gulfport, Mississippi to Walnut Creek, California. The first leg of my trip I left out, dropped my son off at about 6 in the evening, drove 7 hours to the Louisiana-Texas rest area on the border of Louisiana and Texas right around Shreveport, slept in my car 4 hours. Got up at around 04:05 and started driving west. Made it all the way over to the far side of New Mexico, where I had a friend that I've known for a few years. She was a nurse at the local hospital after Hurricane Katrina, and she just happened to be over here doing a traveling nurse job. So I crashed out in her hotel room while she was working. So I actually got a bed that night, slept there for about 5 hours, got back up, drove 16 hours across Arizona and up through California, and making it to Walnut Creek Friday evening. Finally got a good night's rest Friday evening. Saturday, showed up to Travis Air Force Base to go ahead and register for travel. Registered, all of my paperwork was in order. I got approved. There was a flight that was leaving out from Travis Air Force Base with a stop at Hickam Air Force Base, ending up in Kadena Air Base in Okinawa, Japan. So I went ahead and put my name in for that flight and waited around, marked myself present. Roll call was at 06:30, 73 seats available, 20 passengers. Everyone that was available to fly for that flight got a seat, including myself. No less than 4 times were my passport checked, my ID checked, my boarding passes checked, and people were looking at computer terminals while all of this was happening. So if there was any possibility that anything was out of the ordinary, it would have been discovered at that point.
We would have hoped.
I would have hoped. Everything went through, cleared security, waited in the secured area, got on a bus, went out to the aircraft, found out the aircraft had a hydraulic leak, went back to the terminal, got back on the bus, found out it had electrical problems, went back into the terminal, and then finally they're like, hey, we're ready to go. Got back out to the bus, pretty much 5 hours after we were supposed to have departed, we got wheels up. 5.5, 6 hours later, landed at Hickam Air Force Base. Everybody got off the airplane. People grabbed their checked baggage, walked out, went into the unsecured area of the terminal. The people that were staying in Hawaii went on their way. The people that were continuing on to Kadena went back in line to go through the whole security process again, join your documents and everything else. I made it through the process the second time. No hits, no questions, no nothing. Went through the security checkpoint again, took my belt off my pants, my shoes off, everything out of my pockets, wedding ring, watch, necklace. Walked through the metal detector, gathered all my things, and went and waited in the secured area. They actually called us kind of early and said that the aircraft was ready, so we boarded the bus, and then they said that the aircraft needed to refuel. They had about 45 minutes left on fueling, so we got back off the bus, back into the waiting area that was in the secured area of the AMC terminal. And about 15 minutes later, an airman with the AMC terminal came and got me and told me that I needed to go get some issues figured out with U.S. Customs. So we went back to the section of the airport where we'd actually come through earlier, but there was no one there. The lights were turned out. The doors were locked. So he was kind of perplexed with the situation and invited me back to, I guess, the airman's break room for the AMC terminal, which I considered another secured area of the facility. And I was left there alone for about 15 or 20 minutes. I poked my head around a couple of times during those 15 or 20 minutes to try to get an update, see if he's heard anything. I knew that when I was pulled away from the situation, the aircraft was supposed to be refueling, and I'd heard somebody else say that they'd taken the passengers back out to the bus. So I was getting kind of upset at that point, asking a little bit more often, how much longer is this going to take? Because if the plane's still there, we don't get this situated or figured out, I'd like to go. We can figure something out later. They said they were working on it. About that time, a couple of Air Force Security Forces personnel showed up. They were dressed in their battle equipment, spare magazines, M4 rifles. One of the M4s had a 203 grenade launcher attached.
Oh, geez.
And one of the airmen was carrying around a 50 cal ammo can, which I would assume had maybe 20 grenades in it, 15 or 20 grenades in it.
Why don't you tell the listeners what exactly is an M4?
An M4 is a military assault rifle. It's a shortened carbine version of the M16A2 rifle. It's designed more for close quarters combat and room clearing type operations. Shoots a 5.56 or 223 caliber projectile, weighs 62 grains, and has a steel core round in it designed to penetrate some lower levels of body armor and keeps the flight trajectory more stable in flight than a 55 grain bullet. And it's typically shot out of a 1-in-7 twist barrel.
Sounds like the James Bond movie when they ask Bond, hey, you know anything about this gun?
I do firearms instruction on the side as well.
Okay, there you go. I was wondering how you knew, because you're not even a military man.
Yeah, 203 grenade launcher, shoots a 40mm grenade. The grenade is fragmentation grenade, high explosives. Fortunately for me, if they would have shot me with that, it probably wouldn't have blown up because it has to fly so far downrange before it arms itself. So no risk of getting blown up there.
Right.
So that was a good thing. They didn't use anything on me, so I'm very thankful for that. I guess about an hour or so later, DOD police showed up. They sent one police officer, I guess from the Navy side over. So I was being guarded by DOD police, Air Force security forces, and then finally a lady comes in of Asian descent, hands me a Coke, apologizes that they don't have any water available. She didn't introduce herself at first, so I thought she was just a civilian that was working at the terminal and felt sorry for me sitting around.
Right.
She was on the phone. She went back outside, and I guess about an hour or so, she comes back in and introduces herself as a senior special agent with U.S. Customs, Immigration, and Enforcement, or ICE for short.
Right.
Started asking me some questions, but there were some other people present, so we moved into a more secure office and closed the door behind us. And both of the airmen that were armed, the DOD police officer were there. There was a couple other people that were involved in the initial detainment that stayed in the room. And she started asking me questions. How did I get on the airplane at Travis? And I explained to her the very same details that I explained earlier in this conversation. I showed up, had all of the paperwork in order, went through all of the procedures, and got on the aircraft and flew out here. That's how I got there. And she asked me again, because she kind of thought, I guess, that I snuck on the aircraft. And a C-5, if anyone knows the layout of a C-5, it's the United States military's largest cargo plane in its inventory, to my knowledge. And it does have a passenger seating section that's in the tail of the aircraft. But to access that, you either have to crawl up a ladder inside the cargo compartment, or you have to take a ladder up the outside of the aircraft about 25, 30 feet to get into the passenger compartment. And it's completely segregated from the flight deck of the aircraft. It's completely on the opposite end of the tail. So not the easiest part of the aircraft to get into if you try to sneak into it.
And that's the Galaxy, right?
Yes, a C-5 Galaxy. Older aircraft, which could probably explain the hydraulic leaks and mechanical problems at Travis.
Right, I see it first flew in 1968.
Yeah, it's an old airplane. Fairly comfortable. They had nicer seats than most modern airliners. The seats were actually wider. There was plenty of room for my bag under the seat. Very comfortable aircraft to fly in.
But a lot of noise.
The C-5 aircraft has this distinctive high-pitched whine, and you have to wear earplugs or you'll lose hearing inside the aircraft,
right,
as well as outside.
Right.
Very distinctive. No matter where they fly in the world, you hear that sound, you know what it is.
Mm-hmm. When those heavily armed military men came in, you said an hour later that lady showed up from ICE,
yeah,
right? Okay, so what happened within that hour's time frame? Were you just like hanging around and they're hanging around with their guns and were you guys talking?
They were standing up with their guns. Right. I was standing around. I sat down for a minute. I stood up and I said, hey guys, sit down. I'd already walked up and introduced myself, shook their hands, so they knew I wasn't a threat. I had to go to the restroom a couple of times and I tried not to think about the perception that the people in the terminal had of me because I was dressed fairly professional, wearing a black polo and coyote colored 511 pants with black boots. So I did look kind of official, like I'd belonged walking around the terminal with somebody with a gun. But it felt really weird to have to be escorted to the urinal by three people with firearms. I guess they thought I may try to make a break for it or something like that, but I was not familiar at all with the terminal, the layout, the area. It would have been stupid to try to run anyway, because where would I go? I'm on an island.
Right, plus they don't know you. But what do you look like, Wade, physically?
Physically, I'm 6 feet tall, dark hair, dark eyes, weighed about 220 pounds. I've got some facial hair. My hair's cut pretty short, almost into military standards, but not quite.
So you're a big guy. You could present a threat.
It could be perceived that I could.
How long were you actually in that holding pattern there until the next significant event occurred?
In the holding pattern for probably about 3 hours, 4 hours or so. Time kind of went along at a weird pace. So it was somewhere between 3 and 5 hours I was detained. I'd say four,
wow,
four and a half. because it kind of all runs together. But during the time that I was waiting, I had conversations with these guys about 9/11, and some of them picked up their cell phones and started looking up videos of it and going, man, that's pretty weird. I said, hey, look, I don't want to get you guys in trouble or anything. You know, you might want to go do that in your own time. I said, but hey, you're going to come up with two possible conclusions. One, I'm a nutcase and I deserve to be under some sort of indefinite detention that I'm under. Or you're going to say, you know, hey, this guy is on to something, you know, maybe I ought to start asking my own questions.
Right.
And they were completely professional the entire time. I was very impressed with the caliber of people that the Air Force has doing their security. Had this been TSA or airport police, I'm pretty sure that I would have been detained, handcuffed, and mistreated. I don't know if the reason that they didn't go that route is because my wife was an officer or not. I'll never know. But they did treat me with respect and integrity, and I really do appreciate everyone's professionalism throughout the whole ordeal.
That's the least they could do, though.
That is the least they could do. I understand that they were just following orders. It wasn't them particularly that was detaining me. They were following orders from someone above, and
right.
I completely understand that. When the senior special agent from ICE explained to me that, okay, here's the problem. You're on the no-fly list. You cannot fly. You should not have gotten on that aircraft, but you cannot leave. You cannot leave this island on an aircraft. And I was shocked. She started asking me questions. How do I think I was on the no-fly list? I talked about 9/11 a little bit with her. I talked about the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 that has an indefinite detention provision in it. And I told her, I said, ma'am, this is kind of feeling a lot like NDAA 2012. I mean, I'm being detained by the military right now. I understand I'm on a military base, but this is falling right in line with the very same things that I'm vocal about. And this is really scary.
Right.
And she said she's sorry. She tried to find some sort of resolution so I could continue on my way, but the people at higher up said, no, I'm the right person. There's no way that I'm getting on an airplane. And
it's almost funny.
It is, because now I can laugh about it and go, well, guess what? You're wrong.
Especially because you're heading out tomorrow morning.
Yeah, exactly. I asked her if she had a card, some sort of contact information. I wanted to make sure that I had her name right. And I've been very respectful of her privacy because I know people that are in federal service like that. I have a cousin that's in the FBI that I'd called after the event to try to get some guidance. I knew he couldn't tell me if there was a case against me or anything like that, but I flat out asked him if I should turn myself in. But she was very professional throughout the whole ordeal. She was very apologetic about the situation. She was kind of perplexed by the situation because they were not telling her why I was on this list or what I was being accused of or anything. It's just that I could not fly because the higher up said so. And when I started producing a transportation worker identification credential, that's a TWIC card that is issued by TSA, saying that I've completed a background investigation by the FBI and I am not a terrorist or have any ties to terrorism. I laid down a Merchant Mariner document, which is issued by the U.S. Coast Guard. There is a background check required for that. I laid down an emergency management ID. There's no background check for that, but it shows that I had access to the government, and I explained that I had FEMA credentials and things of that sort as well. Then finally, I saved my concealed carry firearms permit for last because it was the most relevant of all of them because I had to conduct a background investigation that was done by the FBI to vet me to get that concealed carry permit.
Right.
To carry a loaded firearm in the state of Mississippi, you have to do that background investigation or you don't get to carry it concealed. And Mississippi is a weird state. If you don't get a permit like that, you can't open carry a firearm or conceal carry a firearm. And you can only carry it concealed in Mississippi. There's no open carry. So if you do want to carry a gun for your own safety, you have to get one of those permits. And I chose to go the route to get the enhanced permit, so I didn't have to worry about, can I carry my gun into this establishment or not? Because there's been times before I got my enhanced permit, I'd walk up to a business and they'd have a sign that says firearms prohibited. I'd have to go back out and put my firearm in the car, because had I entered that business with that sign up, I would have been in violation of a statute and could have faced a fine and possibly jail time.
Right.
But with the enhanced permit, those signs no longer matter. So I can go into a building that says firearms prohibited and not have to worry about any legal ramifications of possessing a loaded firearm there. And those places I could travel with the FBI background check completed on me and the proper training classes for use of deadly force and the current laws that affect the enhanced carry, I could carry in schools, I can carry in government buildings, I could carry in bars and things like that. There's a list basically that says I can't carry in police stations. So I think it's a little bit gray area for places of nuisance and stuff like that. But I don't plan on going to bars. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't do any type of illicit drug whatsoever. So places where I would need a firearm to defend myself, I tend to avoid to go to those places.
Right.
Because I don't like confrontation.
Right. But you never know when these things are going to happen. And it's always better to be armed than a target.
Well, there was an incident that compelled me to get a concealed carry permit. There's actually a couple of incidents, but the one that really got me carrying a gun even without the permit was an incident where I was coming home from work one night working at Ingalls Shipbuilding, and a gentleman approached me and asked me for some money. I did not have any cash on me, and I apologized, told him I wish I could help him, but I just didn't have any cash. And he asked me basically to take my ATM card, go into the ATM, pull out whatever I could pull out, buy him a pack of cigarettes and give him the money.
Sure, no problem.
Yeah, and I'm looking at this guy. I've sized him up already. He's obviously got some sort of weapon. I'm hoping it's a gun and not a knife, because that's going to really suck if it's a knife, because I don't like getting cut.
Right.
And I figured this is all getting processed at light speed. There's going to be a physical altercation involved with this guy. So regardless of what he has, I want to get kind of close to him, and I'm going to take it from him.
What was his race?
He was African American.
Okay.
I kind of closed the distance with him a little bit, laughing about the situation to kind of lighten up his mood. And when I got within arm's reach where I knew if he were to pull anything, I would have access to either put it up in the air to the side or something like that, to where if he did fire or try to stab me, I'd have another opportunity to grab it from him. And he reached down in his belt, pulled out a 9mm hot point pistol. And I'm thankful that it wasn't a revolver, or he could have blew my hand off. I pushed forward the slide on the gun with my right hand, and with my left hand came up, twisted the gun out of his hand, and simultaneously elbowed him in the face, knocking him to the ground with my left elbow.
Nice.
I ejected a live round out of the gun to make sure that it did indeed have a round chambered, and I ordered him to the ground or I was going to kill him. And he complied, lucky for him.
Yeah.
It took the police department about 12 minutes to show up, and I was the bad guy because I had the gun.
When seconds count, the police are only minutes away.
To make the long story short, they ordered me to drop the gun. I refused to drop the gun until I'd cleared the weapon, rendered it safe, and threw it far, far away from me so he couldn't lunge forward and grab it, because I'm not too confident that they would shoot and hit him and not hit me.
Right.
So I wanted to completely take that loaded firearm out of the situation, and then I put my hands up. They handcuffed me, went inside, reviewed the video. A sergeant came out with the police department and told me what I did was incredibly stupid.
Yeah, you're alive.
I said, yes, sir, you're absolutely correct. I should have triple tapped him as soon as I pulled the gun out of his hands.
Right.
I would have been well within my rights.
What did he say when you said that?
He said, well, that would have been murder. No, sir, it wouldn't have. He's already proved that he meant me harm. Imminent jeopardy had been met. Had he done anything else but exactly what I told him to do, I gave him an ultimatum. Had he not done exactly as I told him, I would be covered under the law if I had to shoot him in my defense. If I told him to get on the ground and he stepped toward me, done. Because he's already had the gun, I've taken it from him, and I am not about to get into a fight to struggle for the gun back. I would have triple tapped him.
He picked the wrong guy, obviously.
I guess he underestimated me because I was dressed in work clothes, covered in paint. I had paint on my face. And that was the first time I've seen it done on TV. I've never practiced it, but it was just one of those things that clicked in my mind. That's what I had to do at that exact moment. It wasn't anything I was trained to do, but it worked. So I got lucky.
Thank goodness. It wasn't just luck. It was skill and it was planning. Did you happen to follow this complete waste of Fletch's career to find out where he ended up?
I really wasn't too concerned with it. They probably just gave him probation or something like that. I think he'll think twice before going up to somebody like that again, because when I took the gun from him and he was on the ground and his own gun was fixing to be used on him, I'm pretty sure he saw his life flash before his eyes, because he was very apologetic at that point. He was begging for his life, and I just told him, hey, you do anything else but what I tell you, I will kill you. I'm done. You're a dead man if you don't do exactly what I say.
So you had to hold the gun over him for 12 minutes.
12 minutes.
Oh, my God.
I wish I could get a copy of the video from the store, but the police department took it, and I don't think they're going to release it. Maybe I could file some sort of Freedom of Information Act request and upload it to YouTube. But it was a very interesting, intense situation. And had the situation I'd been in taken place in some other country, I may not have been so peaceful as I was here, because it would have been a very serious situation had I been stranded overseas.
This had an impact on why you wanted to get that concealed carry permit.
It absolutely did, because I never want to be in the situation where someone else has to jump on me with a firearm. When I went through the training, I had to kind of retrain myself in muscle memory, because you have to go through those motions at least 1,000 times to gain the muscle memory to draw a gun from a holster and be able to do it under fire or in a stressful situation. It's something that does have to be practiced. So I had to start practicing pulling it from a concealed position, presenting the firearm, and dry firing it several times before I went to the class, and figure out where it's comfortable to carry and things like that. So by the time I went to the class, I was able to present the weapon and fire 2 rounds within 3 seconds, which is generally what they would like to see for a person carrying a concealed semi-automatic firearm.
So perhaps these people over at the airport, they might have some knowledge in how difficult it is to get a concealed carry permit, perhaps not in Mississippi, but in general, and that they were probably a little more confused now about why you're on this no-fly list, right?
It definitely confused them, because it was so recent. That's the thing that I really pushed. It's like, I just got this the other day. The FBI just finished a background check. So whatever happened must have happened very quickly and very recently. That's why I'm perplexed about the situation.
Right.
Because I've been talking about 9/11 for years. I've talked about the NDAA since November of last year. So something changed that had to be recent. And I am totally clueless to what that could be.
And you're still clueless about that.
I'm still clueless about that. I've had some friends that filed some Freedom of Information Act requests on my behalf. And when I do get back to the house, I'm going to go ahead and file the Freedom of Information Act request to both Department of Homeland Security as an entire entity and directly to TSA as a sub-entity under DHS.
Right.
And ask for any and all information that they may have that has my name on it, my Social Security number on it, my photos on it, audio recordings, any type of phone recordings, emails that they've intercepted. I'm going to ask for everything that they can possibly have on me.
That's great.
And if they do honor that request, it will give me an idea about how invasive government has come into our lives.
Right.
I'm on a Navy base right now. I'm talking on a phone in a hotel room. All of these communications are being monitored.
Right.
I know my cell phone's being monitored. I know my email's being monitored. My keystrokes may be logged on my home computer. Every website I visit is logged. And I fully understand and know that I'm being watched. And I don't care, because I am not doing anything that is illegal or immoral. So as far as I'm concerned, if they have a problem with that, they can go pound sand.
So what happened then, Wade? You tell them about the concealed carry permit, and what happened after that? It was, you said, between 3 and 5 hours you were stuck there. What happened after that?
They're confused. They're perplexed about the situation. They don't understand, one, how I just passed a background check and how I'm on a no-fly list. There has to be some mistake, but there's not, because my name and Social Security number match the information that they've been given. So it gets to the point where they're just like, well, there's nothing more we can do here. I'm sorry, but you can't leave via aircraft. You're free to go. That's it. I'm not being detained. I'm free to go, but I can't leave in an airplane.
You're on a 30-mile rock.
I am not free to go then. I'm free to leave here and go be imprisoned on the island, but I'm not free to go.
It gives rock fever a whole new meaning.
Yes, it does.
So they said you could leave. So you actually took your backpack and...
I took my backpack, and I never got searched through this entire ordeal, which is very interesting.
Wow.
So that tends to make me believe that it was more politically motivated than intel motivated, like I may have had something on my person or in my bag that was questionable.
Right.
If you use a little bit of common sense, they were not interested in what I was carrying. They were interested in me. That kind of adds a little bit of suspicion to the reasoning behind it. I was released. The gentleman with the M4s escorted me out of the airport. We had a brief conversation. I shook both of their hands, thanked them for being professional and not shooting me or bashing bashing my face into the concrete.
Right.
And I use those exact words, bashing my face into the concrete. I really appreciated that and their level of professionalism, and this will all get sorted out.
And they must have laughed at that, right?
Yeah, they is like, we're not going to bash your face into the concrete. We don't do that. That's like somebody else.
Right.
The DOD police officer, I thanked him for his service and not violating my rights. I even thanked the customs official for being professional. I asked her for her card. She gave me her card. And I asked her, I said, can I set up a meeting with the FBI tomorrow if there's something in my past that we need to get ironed out? Or you want to charge me with a crime for something? Let's get all of this out of the way because I want to be on my way to go see my wife. So please give me a call tomorrow. And she never gave me a call the next day, so I was proactive. I contacted her. She said that she's working on a remedy, and lo and behold, she had been working on it, but I was impatient. So I started calling people on the phone, calling family, letting them know what's going on. I called my wife and I sent her an email initially telling her I was detained, and then we spoke on the phone.
Did they mind if you used the phone? Did you try to call your wife?
They never asked me if I needed a phone call. I was on my phone texting that I'd been detained already.
Okay.
They didn't take my phone from me or anything else like that. Only regret that I have is I didn't take some pictures with the Air Force guys that detained me, because that's probably one part of the story that people probably would not believe unless they were in the military and understand that that is standard operating procedure for the type of incident that I was involved with.
So you left the terminal, you left the airport.
I left.
You just walked?
No, they called the taxi cab for me.
Okay.
I got in the taxi cab. I'd made a couple of phone calls to secure lodging. I'd called over at the Arizona Hall, and they said that they had space available for me to come check in. So I got in the taxi. I waited a while. The DOD police officer stayed there with me until I got in my cab. And I shook his hand, thanked him for his professionalism again, and thanked the special agent for being straight up with me and trying to do everything she could do, and told her, we're going to get this sorted out, and this is going to get fixed.
This was a Sunday, right? Going into,
yes,
I guess, the early hours of Monday.
Yes, that's correct. Got in the taxi. The taxi took me to the wrong place, took me to Ford Island.
Great.
Stayed there for about 30, 45 minutes. Got another taxi out of there. Decided to pay 2 cab fares to get over to check in for the hotel.
And it ain't cheap in Hawaii, right?
No, it's not. I spent $45 in taxis the first night.
Right.
So I wasn't feeling too hot about my situation at that point. I got the hotel, got the room, walked up to the room, got in there, threw my bag down, and kicked off my shoes, and just laid in the bed, and I could not go to sleep. I got on my phone, and I started texting and sending emails and letting everyone I could know about my situation. It was getting daybreak over in Central Time on the lower 48 CONUS, so that first day, I did not get any sleep. I went a good 30, maybe 36 hours before I crashed out.
Wow, that's big. I did that once before, and you start to get delirious.
You start going into autopilot. Your
right.
body starts doing predictive things. You start losing motor functions and things like that. So
right.
I got to the point where I was just mentally exhausted and physically exhausted, and I collapsed in the bed and passed out. I only slept about 5 hours. I woke up at, I think, around 0500 Central Time. Throughout this whole ordeal, I've only gotten, I think, at the most 5 hours of sleep.
You were yawning before, and I was going to say exactly that. It hasn't been easy, because this was Sunday. We're talking right now, by me, I'm on the East Coast, it's Friday, about 2 a.m., and what time is it there by you?
It's about 8 p.m.
So after we're done, you're probably going to just lay down and...
Yeah, I've got to be at the AMC terminal 30 minutes before 0430, so I have to be there at 0400. That means that I'm going to have to get up here about 0230, make sure that I've got everything picked up, packed up, secure transportation over to the AMC terminal, and get there well in enough time to make sure that I'm present for roll call and that I'll have a spot on the flight. There's only 10 seats on this flight, so there's the possibility that I could be bumped. My wife had mentioned something about the Navy was supposed to bump my category up to guarantee me passage back home, but they said that I'm only flying Category 4, so I don't think that's going to be possible, but I'm going to address that issue when I do check in tomorrow morning to mark myself present for flying, see if they can make some phone calls where they can guarantee me this flight back so I can beat my wife back and maybe have some flowers or something for her when she comes in.
She should have some flowers for you after what you went through. Perhaps not flowers, but something else, maybe a big steak. You had those 5 hours sleep, you got up, and you tried to start figuring out what was going on. Obviously, you went through Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and just today and Thursday, you found out that everything's okay. What were the significant events that occurred from when you got up after your 5 hours sleep until you found out today that you could fly all of a sudden miraculously? What were the significant things that happened?
I contacted a friend of mine in Pennsylvania, goes by the nickname Patriot John. He's a firefighter up there in Pennsylvania, so we had that common bond. I had a website a few years ago. He became a member of it. Myself, him, and about six other people have talked on Skype since about 2008, almost on a nightly basis. So we've stayed in contact. Most of us have never even met, but we've stayed in contact and talked about issues concerning our liberties and the Constitution. So they're all patriots. I got on the Skype on my phone, started notifying them of the situation that was going on. John is friends with Doug Hagman of the Hagman Report and explained the situation to them, did the initial interview on the phone with them, recount the incident as it happened. They uploaded the news story not only to their website, homelandsecurity.us, also uploaded that and submitted it to Canada Free Press, which published a story and ran with it. That led to Doug Hagman calling up Alex Jones and Infowars.com, notifying them of my situation, and he did an air spot with them. I went on later and did a recorded interview for the Infowars Nightly News. And between the Hagman and Hagman Report radio show, the written pieces for Canada Free Press, HomelandSecurity.us, when the Infowars story came out, there was probably about two or three stories an hour that were getting posted based off of Hagman's story. And it just kept increasing exponentially. I started getting phone calls from other people like yourself that were independent journalists asking these questions and wanting to do an interview and things like that. So I tried to accommodate as many people as I could given the situation, because I don't want to use the word paranoid because that may make me sound like I was crazy, but I guess the best word would be I was more of a heightened state of situational awareness. I was sleeping with one eye open. I didn't know if somebody was going to come kick the door down in the middle of the night and try to snatch me out of my bed or come in through the windows or anything like that. It wasn't a state of paranoia, because if it would have been possible for that, they would have detained me to begin with. But there was that thought in the back of my mind, what happens if they do? So those nights that I have had some sleep, it was broken, I tossed and turned, and I was aware of what was going on. So in essence, I'm not actually going to get any sleep tonight as well, just because of the simple fact that the time crunch and having to get up in the morning and the excitement of being able to fly back to the contiguous United States and...
Some vacation.
A vacation back at home, yeah.
Yeah, right. So. The irony of it is that there are millions and millions and probably hundreds of millions, maybe billions of people across the planet who would die to be in Hawaii. And here's the irony. You were in Hawaii, you couldn't even enjoy 1 minute of it.
I was basically exiled in paradise.
Exactly.
I wanted so bad to go check out the Arizona Memorial and tour the battleship Missouri and that. And I never made it over to Ford's Island to go do that. My wife was telling me, rent a car, buy a computer, buy a suit, go do this, go do that, go see the sights. And I told her, I said, I'm in a situation, and if I had to equate it to anything, I would equate it to a type of combat. I'm now behind enemy lines. I'm trapped, and I don't have a SEAL Team 6 coming to pick me up and extricate me out of the situation. So what limited resources I had with my cell phone and the contacts I had, every waking hour I was texting, talking, working with people, making contacts to the media, trying to get the word out, because I'm a firm believer God helps those who help themselves. And it wasn't going to do me any good to lay in the bed and be completely depressed about the situation and cry about it. It was not going to remedy the situation for me to go sightseeing. My main concern was get this behind me, get myself off the no-fly list, and if it would have took me 2 weeks to do this, I would have been functioning on very limited sleep for 2 weeks to get it done. I was completely dedicated to the mission at hand, right, which is get myself out of here without having to completely break a bank to do so.
Unbelievable. You're on this no-fly list. You have no idea why you're on this no-fly list. Nobody's telling you anything. All the people you contacted through the whole week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and half the day on Thursday, nobody could tell you anything, right?
Nope. we're working on it. We're looking into it. Oh, could you send us a privacy release form so we can talk about your case? You know, I'm like, hey, I'm on a cell phone. You want to record something and let me give you permission to discuss my case? Do you do a digital signature? Send me an email. I'll say, yes, you have my permission to do this. They got to have a wedding signature. So I probably could have got the situation resolved a lot faster, maybe by a day or so, had I been able to get those documents signed and over to my senators and my congressmen. I never did get the release over to my congressman's office. I was going to do it today, but it's not necessary now.
So when did you find out that the nightmare was just about over?
When I was at the governor's office over here in Hawaii, I was working with the constituent relations department that they have at the Capitol. They were giving me numbers to the USO, things like that, different organizations that may be able to help me, a couple of nonprofits that could help with lodging and transportation or something like that, and even food in my situation. They were trying to give me options to not go completely broke while I was over here in Hawaii. And through that process of making some phone calls, they called the FAA. And I think that kind of set some of the things in motion when they started talking to the FAA directly, trying to get answers about the situation locally at the Honolulu airport. And I got word that, hey, stand by, you're fixing to get a call from this senior special agent with ICE. And I'd gotten the word actually from them that I'd been set free.
Allowed to fly.
Allowed to fly, set free.
And you don't have any criminal record at all in your background?
None.
Nothing?
None.
I mean, the most serious thing is maybe a speeding ticket. Do you even have that?
They can't get speeding tickets to stick to me. I show up to court and I will beat a speeding ticket every time. Even if I'm guilty of one, I'll beat it.
Okay. So no speeding tickets, nothing.
Nothing.
What time was this, Wade, that this happened? Your time, Hawaii time?
Probably about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Figure about 6-7 hours ago.
Yeah.
And obviously the wife is happy, I guess.
She's ecstatic. She's super excited. I don't think she has any idea how hard I worked myself to get out of this situation. I know a lot of people out there work just as hard as I did, but I could tell you right now that the amount of work that I put into getting myself out of this situation, I'm going to keep up that same effort to make sure that this never happens to another American citizen again.
That's good. And those FOIAs are going to shed a lot of light on what happened, hopefully.
If they decide to release them.
Right.
It's my personal information they have. It's my property. I'm supposed to be the boss over my government. They're supposed to submit to the will of the people. Within reason, of course. I think my requests are completely reasonable. I do look for some people to lose their jobs over this.
Nice.
It's probably not good for the economy, but I think we can lose a couple of these jobs. They're government jobs, which will reduce our tax liability. So it probably won't be a bad thing to lose a couple of these jobs. And hey, the private sector is looking for goons to screw over people. So I'm sure they'll find a nice place of employment where they're out of the public sector and not being leeches on society. But I'm going to continue my vigilant efforts because I'm not working right now. I'm going back to school for law school. And I can tell you right now what I'm going to be writing about for the papers that I have to write in law school. And it's going to be specifically about this incident and how to completely eliminate this from happening again.
I mean, it's perfect because you are going to school for constitutional law. And this is something you feel very strongly about. And really, this is something that probably is a blessing in disguise.
It is. I had some interesting conversations with some friends of mine. One of the guys made the comment, he says, well, I never talked to a lottery winner before. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't win no lottery. He says, do you realize the lawsuit you have? I said, it's not about money. I'm not going to sue these idiots over money.
Right.
Realistically, what do they owe me? I'll be honest. They owe me a flight home, an apology, and reimbursement for the expenses I've incurred here.
But they also owe you a vacation.
They do owe me a vacation. They do owe me that time back with my wife that I didn't get to spend with her. And that's where the whole mental anguish part of this comes in. Because although I wasn't in a corner in a ball crying my eyes out hysterically, this has mentally affected me. This has changed who I am. This is the realization of all of my fears come true.
Right.
And that is something that cannot have a price put on it. They may be able to assign a value to it, but if I do get anywhere with any type of lawsuit and I do get any type of lawsuit awarded in my favor, I'm just going to pay it forward and ensure that this is not going to happen to anyone else. I want to make sure that this doesn't happen, so I'll probably use the funds if I do get some sort of settlement from a lawsuit. I'm going to put it towards my college education to get my bachelor's in history with a minor either in psychology or political science and my constitutional juris doctorate in law. And then, whatever money's left over, I'm either going to spend it to run for Congress or Senate, or who knows, I'm going to be 35 here next year. I won't have a law degree by 2016, and I'll make sure if I do get the law degree, that I don't accept the bar oath, because if I do hold public office, I want to make sure that my oath to the Constitution is taken with no reservations whatsoever, and no other oath is going to be able to supersede that oath.
I always say that the government has the unique ability to create activists. They just seem to piss people off.
Yeah, they do. And the problem is when they upset a person like myself that is very strong-willed, very stubborn, and stands on principle, they're just going to have to accept the fact that I'm not going to go away. And if they want to disappear me, pack a lunch. They got me over here pretty good. They really did. Very interesting way they did it. They were pretty good at it, but I know they're after me. There's no doubt that they're after me now, and I can act accordingly when I get back home to keep my head on a swivel and watch my back at all times. Check my vehicle for cut brake lines and things like that, because people that are successful like I am in situations like this, they may have something planned for me when I get back home. So just for the record, for the recording, for the people that listen to this interview, I have never had suicidal thoughts. I will never kill myself. I will never take my own life. I will not drive my car off a cliff. I won't jump off a building. I won't drown myself. I will not put a gun in my mouth and pull the trigger. I love life, and as down as I was in this entire situation, I never thought once about ending my life.
Good.
So that is not even in the realm of possibilities. If anything happens to me physically, no matter how much of an accident it looks like, it needs to be investigated and reinvestigated, because if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. And I've had a very close personal friend of mine that I know was taken out for what he talked about. And he was a Vietnam veteran, Ops 35th Special Forces, and he was very awake and aware of what was going on and knew what was coming, knew that things like this were going to start happening to us. He was very vocal about that. And he did see an untimely end. He was taken from us way too soon.
Wade Hick Jr., again, I want to thank you for all the time you spent explaining all this to listeners, and looking forward to you getting out of there tomorrow morning, and also looking forward to speaking to you again and giving us an update on what's happening.
I sure will. Thanks for having me.